Herzlich willkommen zu Hansa Rauschen, dem Literaturpodcast des Hansa Verlages. Mein Name ist Florian Kessler. Hier sprechen alle zwei Wochen Lektorinnen und Lektoren mit Menschen aus der Welt der Bücher, mit Schreibenden und Lesenden, mit Leuten von anderen Verlagen und aus dem Haus. Es geht um alles, was in Bücher passt und außenrum passiert. Und das ist wirklich nicht wenig. Die erste Folge unseres Podcasts hatte gleich einen großen Gast. T.C. Boyle war im Februar in Deutschland zu Besuch und kam auch zu uns in den Verlag. Auf seiner Lesereise präsentierte er seinen neuen, vielbeachteten Roman Das Licht. Das war beileibe nicht T.C. Boyles erster Roman, den er bei Hansa veröffentlichte. Seit einigen Jahren werden diese Romane im Lektorat betreut von Piero Salabé. Piero ist 1970 geboren, promovierte bei Claudio Magris und kann beneidenswert viele Sprachen. Hier bei uns betreut er Romane aus dem englischsprachigen Raum, aus Italien, Spanien und Lateinamerika. Mit T.C. Boyle hat Piero über viele verschiedene Dinge gesprochen. Über schriftstellerische Vorbilder, Produktivität als Autor, Disziplin, die lokale Verortung der Romane, Boyles Liebe zur Natur und überhaupt sein Verhältnis zur Einsamkeit und zum Draußen. Über Lesung und Lesungreisen, genauso wie über Religion und Wissenschaft. Und auch die große Frage, warum T.C. Boyle vermutlich niemals eine Autobiografie schreiben wird, aber hoffentlich noch viele Romane. Und gesprochen wurde natürlich auf Englisch. Wir starten also gleich schön voraussetzungsreich mit unserem Podcast. Viel Spaß.
What if I talk really high like this?
Now, Piero, I'm totally oppressed by this thing because I'm watching to see whether it blinks red. The red starts blinking.
But we just forget it. If you want some alcohol, this is supposed to be free wheel, so we can, you know, just read some pages of your.
But
most
should,
recent novel in order to get, you know.
Yes, but shouldn't we, if it's freewheeling, shouldn't we just drink flaming shots of 151 rum first and then do it?
I think you're right. it's so good to have you here to talk with you, and I will try to ask you, you know, not the usual questions on the book, but just generally, and you can just tell me whatever you want. You can also ask me things if you're interested or curious, because it's not a fair situation that I put you questions and you have to answer.
And I can ask you questions too.
Exactly. So you're entitled to do that. Tom, the first thing I wanted to know is, I know some authors who say, well, I don't read books, you know, I don't want to be influenced. Are you that kind of person as well? Or?
It depends on the moment. So, of course, I'm inspired by my fellow writers. This is how you learn to be an artist, by admiring the work of other artists. I can read novels mostly when I'm writing short stories, which is a period that I've been in lately. But when I'm writing a novel, it's very difficult to read another novel, because the hardest thing in doing a long work is to maintain your vision and especially the voice. So if I were to read a powerful novel with a strong voice while writing my novel, it might make my novel more erratic. So I'm very careful about that.
Yeah. Is it possible that you feel like you are in a mood or you have found a voice and you have the impression that this voice is close to some model or some author, which can even help you in sort of developing better, or just reading it, sometimes just bits, sorts of parts, or you just...
Absolutely. Say. So in the beginning, when you're a young writer, you are consciously adapting your heroes and their work and their mode of writing. It's instinctive, it's natural. But of course, you're doing it in your own way and you're taking all of your influences, so you're not really aping anyone. Later on, though, when, of course, you have your own distinct voice, it is not quite like that. Although, in some of my longer novels, I find a sense of exhaustion after a while, you know, working every day, all day for a year. And I like to reread William Faulkner, one of my heroes, just to remind myself of the length of the line, the beat of the line, and how to really do a rant That is Faulkner for me. So there are some authors I will read in the middle of writing a book. I'm no longer teaching at the university, but when I was, I would use several contemporary novels per semester to talk to the students about, and I would reread them, no matter what I'm writing at the time. I don't know if it adversely affected my work, because I'm rereading a book and reading it rather quickly. So, you know, there are always exceptions.
I was, once you told me that you write a lot of novels, obviously you've written 16 novels now, and there's a new one now, right? And you say everyone is sort of really impressed of this productivity you have. And you once told me something very evident. You know, a day I write one page a day, a year has got 356 days. So, in fact, I would be able, if I am in the right rhythm, to write a novel in such a time, obviously, but this changes from work to work. When you're very much into that writing process of the novel, as you're saying that you are developing a voice and you don't want the distractions, are you dreaming in that time? Are you dreaming in the sense of when you go to sleep and you wake up in the morning, you remember your dreams? Or is it something...
I don't remember my dreams much anymore. I used to more. I don't know what that's all about. But I'm writing the book from the unconscious mind. Once I'm done with work at 2 in the afternoon or 2:30, whatever it is, I don't consciously think about the book anymore at all until the next morning when I see it on the screen and I'm rewriting what I've written the day before. But somehow, this process in the unconscious mind, through whatever I might be doing, is working on the problem. It's a problem to solve. What are the themes? Where is it going? Who are the characters? How would they respond? And beyond just the plot itself, of course, what's going to happen? And you make these little discoveries day by day. That's the fun of it. That's why I am simply a novelist and have never wanted to be a man of letters. I don't want to give speeches. I don't want to write essays. I'm fascinated by fiction and how it works. And this is my 28th book. I think by the time I've written 28 more, I'll have figured something out about life.
I mean, one of the things I'm most impressed in your whole work is the variety of subjects you address. The infinite number of characters you present us with the most different psychologies. How does this process of developing fantasy, how does this work?
Each story and each novel just creates itself anew. It's the magic. It's why I do it. I don't know. I very rarely have I ever based any characters on somebody I know. They might be an amalgam of people I know or a type of person, but they're all kind of created sui generis on their own. They just appear. There are exceptions. Ruth Dershowitz of East is East is a portrait of a friend of mine, and she wasn't very happy about that portrait at first, but now as the years have gone by, she's kind of pleased to have been incorporated in a novel in some spirit. Then there is Vogelsang of Grüneste Hoffnung, Budding Prospects. This guy is an extraordinary character who is half mad, always has been. And I couldn't help portraying him exactly as he is, as the villain of this book. He loves it. He loves this, that he's the villain of the book. When it was being made into a TV series last year, he was on every moment of it. He knows everything about it. This is the highlight of anything. He wants to be the villain of a book. He loves it. So you can never tell.
No, I appreciate this very much because I always thought that you're a very discreet author, if I can use this adjective, in the sense that I felt particular respect for the characters. And I also felt that you're not introducing, say, autobiographical material directly into the novel. Obviously, there must be a link. There must be a link. So I was fascinated by the way you can create these universes, from your desk, being in your desk. So you have developed all these worlds. And the next question is, starting from one of the most famous books, obviously, Water Music. How did that book come to you?
Peter, you're telling me these wonderful things, and I'm beginning to get nervous because I'm thinking, what the hell am I doing? Why aren't I writing the new book yet? So Water Music is a ready-made story. I discovered Mungo Park through a reference in the writings of John Ruskin when I was doing my PhD in 19th century British literature. So it was a curious reference. Ruskin had said, well, this guy Mungo Park, he's a great hero of the Scottish people, but examine him morally. I mean, he went off on his adventures and died, leaving his wife and a bunch of children behind. What about them? So I tucked that away in my mind, and then I read Mungo Park's Explorations in West Africa, which is still in print, and it's a wonderful book. So all of his experiences in this book actually happened. So that part of the story, I could use his book and retell it in my way. The other part of the story of Ned Rise is purely invented, but it has to do with my fascination of the culture of the time, of the lower classes, of the gin shops, and all of that. And it was certainly a product of my studying for my PhD and absorbing all this learning. And of course, it's my first novel, and it's completely wild and crazy. And I didn't know if I could write a novel. I'd only written short stories to that point. In fact, I'd written a book of short stories already. I learned how to write a novel by writing that one, and I love it, and I'm so happy. I wish I'd write another one just like it, but you move on, and I don't want to repeat myself. I want to do something different each time.
This novel has an enormous strength. I think it's a modern classic, and what strikes me is that the hero is a Scotsman, it takes place in Africa, and then most of your novels basically take place in the States. And you come from upstate New York, all the same, this region is not subject in many books. I think it's The World's End where it's the subject. But then you move towards more the western part.
It was accidental that I wound up in Los Angeles and now in Santa Barbara. And it completely changed my perspective and gave me an enormous amount of material. I am now a Californian, but always my perspective and my heart are in New York. So I see things differently from the native Californians, which enabled me to write, for instance, America, my most famous book. That kind of dislocation to a new place was, in my case, great. So I was the finalist for three academic jobs when I finished at Iowa. One was in Minnesota. The one in LA at University of Southern California came through first, and so I went there. But what if I had gone to Minnesota? Instead of the tortilla curtain, America, about the wall and the immigrants from Mexico, well, I would have written the saga of the Swedes coming to Minnesota. Who knows? So it's so curious as to where life leads us, particularly artistically, in terms of material. Mm-hmm.
Though many authors are very much related to the place they come from, even if they are in exile or they change their country. In your case, you're very much related to the place you moved to, I have the impression, also, especially.
There's a demarcation in my short stories. If the short stories are not set in a specific place, like in Africa or in Norway. I've written stories set everywhere. They're set in New York, the first half of my life. Now they're set in California. Simple as that.
New York has been portrayed as a classical symbol of dystopian literature, and many of your novels are dystopian. But this city particularly doesn't play such a strong role in your literature.
Yes, I grew up in the suburbs of New York, 30 miles north of the city, in Peekskill, named after Jan Peek, the Dutch explorer who first found the place more than 500 years ago. I am much more comfortable in a suburban environment than I am in an urban environment. And as I age and get a little crankier, I want to see people less and less, and only on my own terms. So I'm living in a village near Santa Barbara now, where I can walk everywhere. I know everybody in town. I have wonderful relationships. I go kayaking on the ocean. The village has lots of nice restaurants and bars and places to hang out. It's all good. But when even that gets too much for me, I go up to the mountains in the Sierras, where it's not even a village, it's just a community that has one bar restaurant and maybe 100 cabins out in the woods. They're houses, but we call them cabins. But a permanent population of 32 people. And so I get away from, not only from an urban setting like New York, which I see a couple of times a year when I go to visit, but also a small city like Santa Barbara, to a remote place. When I'm done with work up there, I just walk right out the door and I am in the Sequoia National Forest and I never see anybody. And I will tell you a story to this effect. So when I was writing Drop City, so it would have been around 2001, 2002, I was up there by myself for a given period because my children were still young and in school, and Frau Boyle had to stay home and take care of them. And I was working intensely every day and not paying attention to what was going on in the world. And someone said to me, "What are you going to do this weekend?" I said, "What do you mean?" They said, "Well, it's Memorial Day. Memorial Day in America is to memorialize the various wars. And it's a national holiday, and it's always on a Monday, and you get a day off, 3-day weekend." So I said, "Oh, shit, now there's going to be a bunch of tourists coming up here, and what am I going to do, and they'll interfere with me." Sure enough, the next day, I was walking out to my favorite waterfall in the woods after work, just thinking pure thoughts, and I had to cross a logging road, a dirt road made by logging trucks in the past. And I heard an automobile coming, but it was sort of an L shape and I couldn't see it. It was off here somewhere. I heard it coming. What am I going to do? I crouched down and hid in the bushes until the car went by. That's how I feel, Piero.
Even like a, you know, an animal.
Yes, within exactly. Yeah. I relate to the animals much more than I relate to my fellow human beings at certain times.
At certain times, yes. I mean, it's the famous friend of the earth.
But I do like the love call of Frau Boyle, though. Yeah. I have to admit that.
I have to ask you one crucial question, because we're in Germany, and as you know, Germans love you, venerate. Once you were asked on the stage, why do Germans love you so much? And your answer was quite simple. They are very smart.
No, they have great literary taste as well as being very smart. But so, I came up with a second answer a few nights ago. I was asked this.
Yes.
And it's the simplest expression there is. Love. It's love. This is my best foreign country. In Italy, I sometimes go, but I'm not very popular. I've had a couple of different publishers. In England, I've been with the same publisher for a long time, but I'm not popular, as popular there either. In France, same publisher all my life. I love them and I do fairly well. But I think the difference here is English. so many of the Germans are conversant with English so that I can perform and talk to them in my own way. And because of long relationship, it's been 30 years I've been coming and doing performances, and the crowd has grown. And it's a small country, so that in my very first book of water music, was I presenting water music? No, it wouldn't have been that early. It would have been Das Summer I Found Savannah, East is East. I came here and I was not well known. I started in Heidelberg with Anna Leuba, who was my moderator, and had to do the German part as an actress. And boy, did she come to life when the audience started to laugh. And it was a packed bookstore, a beautiful day of rain driving down. Oh, it had such a great feeling, like a nightclub. By the end of the tour, 2 weeks later, we were in Munich, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people because they called one another on the phone. They said, hey, you got to see this guy. He's in town. And it's just grown from there. So that it's huge and wonderful. You know, whenever I come 6 months in advance, every hall sells out. I love this. And so I want to give some of that affection back. And this is why I sign everybody's book. And I want to talk to everybody because I am honored by the affection that I'm being shown. So it's an unusual relationship, but I'm so happy for it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that also the kind of commitment which is in all of your books, even it's never literally, is something which appeals a lot the Germans? The sense of, you know, defending the nature of...
Oh, certainly. Yes,
this,
certainly.
This is something, yeah.
But I would think that book people everywhere would be in tune with what I believe in and what my themes are. I hope that my audience worldwide is just appealing or appreciating art. I'm just an artist. I have no pretense. I'm not selling anything or pushing anything. I don't put politics into my literature except as you interpret it and read between the lines, you know what I stand for. And maybe that's refreshing. And also, you know, I like to perform before the public. I like to give a good show. I've often been misunderstood, willfully misunderstood, because I say that all art is entertainment. I don't mean to cheapen art. I am the most sincere artist you will ever find. I used to be a singer in a rock and roll band. I'm very outgoing. I love to perform and before the audience. Maybe people respond to this.
Yes, I am sure that this your generosity, which I even hear as a someone who works with you, I have always appreciated and everyone knows. So this is something you can really convey, I think, to the readers. And this must be one of the reasons, mm-hmm. Of course.
Yes, yeah. But of course, my work is on the page.
Exactly.
And yeah. It's meant to be read on the page by yourself, and you have your own interaction with it, as with all books, which is why books are the most special form of entertainment, because it's recreated by the reader. So authors don't really have to go before the public. Many authors are introverted. That's why they're authors to begin with. They don't want to deal with anybody. I respect that. But I'm different, and I enjoy this part of the process. However, once it's over, you won't see me again, because I will become introverted, and I will go home, and I will be quiet and hide out and see what is next, because this is fun, but my real life is the work itself.
Exactly.
I want to see what comes next.
Well, if you tell me about the way you work, sometimes I think you work like a monk somehow with this discipline, extreme discipline. And how does the next book come to you? I mean, the idea, because you are so prolific.
I've just finished 6 new stories. That's half the next book of stories. And now it's time to write a novel. So the last 3 months I've been researching and taking some notes on a subject. So far, it's not sparking anything in me, but I'm also putting it off because I have to tour with Das Licht here.
Yeah.
And outside looking in America.
Yeah.
So I must have a period of time to get deeply into it and see if it will work. I don't know if this will work or if it will come to me.
Yeah. So there are also ideas, subjects that haunt you for a long time, or is it something where you have empty space, you can fill it with something which arises?
I think naturally. It's the latter. It's the latter. It's I have empty latter. Space and I'm looking and for something. And this is particularly great with the stories, because what's happening in our society, and it's transformed so quickly, I must then address it. For instance, the story of the New Yorker this week is called Asleep at the Wheel. And it's my take on the near future with self-driving cars, when there are only self-driving cars. What is that going to be like? Or the story that is being serialized in two parts, I think it's in the Frankfurter Allgemeine, Are We Not Men? This was in the New Yorker 2 years ago. Yeah. And it's about CRISPR-Cas9 technology. That is the new technology that allows us to make transgenic creatures by gene manipulation and much more quickly and easily than before. Well, where is this going? You know? The Relive Box, the title of my last collection of stories, it's about video gaming. What is it? What does it mean? What does it do to us? These are starting points for stories that investigate such things.
I mean, there's a red thread in your literature about this. On one hand, the dream of a new humanity, of something that can go well. On the other side, the reverse of it, this pessimistic aspect. Do you, if we take the famous sentence by Goya, who said, "The dream of reason produces monsters." Well, in Spanish, you know, it's el sueño de la razón. Mm-hmm. And sueño means in Spanish both the sleep and the dream of reason. So in the traditional sense, people would say it's the sleep. I mean, people are not enlightened, don't believe in science, monsters will arise. But you can also read it, if you want, in the other sense, that the dream of reason is the idea that reason can...
It can resolve all problems.
Everything can generate monsters.
Right.
Which of these two interpretation would you rather prefer?
Choice B.
Choice B, yes. So it's
because because it speaks to probably the essence of everything I've ever written, which has to do with our place on this earth as an animal species and our invention of God, for instance. Reason can only take us so far, however. So I abandoned religion as a boy to embrace a mechanistic view of the world and what science allows my five senses to interpret. But now, more than ever, I see that both science and religion are equally voodoo because they don't give us the answer we want. And so this is the essential question of human life and human consciousness. And this is what I'm writing about. I hope I'll have a good solution for it, but I doubt it's going to happen.
Well, I mean, the religious thought has the apocalypse as a horizon, but of course then the other one, the redemption and this. In your literature, the Bible is very present, isn't it? As a literary source, let's say, not quoted literally, but present in the many.
To a degree. But it's interesting how the world's major religions, and also something like Scientology, for instance, certainly Catholicism, certainly Islam, are based on sci-fi novels. When you come to think of it, all the magical legends of the past are a way of trying to explain the inexplicable. And I can't help seeing how these are all constructs of a desperate humanity wanting the answers. In league with this, if you want to really get depressed, We are simply an animal species that has, through evolution, developed the brain power to create all of this, and including our own destruction, which seems imminent given global warming and the vast overpopulation, the decline of the other species, etc. And I begin to wonder whether evolution has given us the brain power to achieve what we've achieved, but that that is fatal, that it is an aberration, that it's a bad adaptation to the environment. The Earth still has 3.5 billion years to go, and other species will arise, other intelligent species will arise after we have done ourselves in. It's not a very happy prospect. We want to think that we are part of a tradition and that we are unique and beautiful and that we are contributing to culture and society. But when you view us as what we are, an animal species doomed not only to individual death but to extinction, where do you find the joy in this except in dwelling in nature, in personal relationships, in love, in art, in culture? That's what we have. And we don't have ultimate reasons. But of course, all we want is the ultimate reason. So in short, we are screwed.
There is an author, an American, I think it's called, his name is Pinker, that has just written a very...
Steven Pinker, yes.
About enlightenment, and he says we are too pessimistic because, in fact, I mean...
Yes, I know of the book. I haven't read it yet. And I should, because I'm sure I will totally disagree with it.
Yeah, but this is, I think, interesting, because your pessimistic view, something which usually readers would find difficult to accept.
It's not necessarily pessimistic. It's an honest point of view. I'm not inventing things in order to make people happy. On the other hand, there is a lot of optimism. There's optimism in the joy of the work itself and optimism in what we're doing now, what we do in a publishing house, what we do in passing down culture, in my being a professor and giving back to the culture what the culture gave to me. All this is totally optimistic. We're only talking about ultimate questions, and there is no resolution to those. So I don't know whether we could really classify it as pessimistic or realistic or magical thinking. I don't know.
Very well. I wanted to ask you...
One more story, Piero, which you may have already heard. When I first started with Hansi Verlag, maybe my first tour, I met here one of the salesmen who was quite beautiful and brilliant man. And... he said this to me. We were having dinner together. He said, well, you know, we're publishing this English author, and she lives in a little village, and she writes very nice novels about village life and people having tea parties together. Then he paused and he said, but you don't write novels like that, do you? I wish I did, you know, in some way.
Tell me something. We have talked about this dystopian aspect in, was it in Friend of the Earth? You had this prospect of 2025. Am I right?
Yes.
So this is in 6 years. Do you think you have been a good prophet?
My very bad joke about this, which I've been using for several years now, is that it's come so quickly. I should have projected it to 2015. Truly. I am shocked by how rapidly the environment is collapsing around us. You know, when I wrote it, I'm sort of a wise guy, and I'm projecting and thinking, ha-ha, it's not going to happen that soon. Maybe 2050 or some time in the future. But it's already here, terribly affecting us, and it's going to cause tremendous dislocations and crop failures and starvation and the rising seas alone. We saw the problems when a gang took over in the Middle East, ISIS, and the Syrian refugee crisis, a terrible, terrible humanitarian crisis. What happens when the sea level rises 6 more inches and all of Bangladesh is permanently flooded, where do these people go? What do they eat? Where do they sleep? Where do they stand? I think we're going to see terrible, terrible things coming in terms of populations dislocated. And one of the stories in my latest book, of the Relief Box, is about an island off of Alaska, which is disappearing, where the Inuit live. And it's disappearing day by day and will be completely gone soon. They had to move the entire population away. I just wanted to dwell on that. The story is called Surtsey. And Surtsey is named after the volcanic island off of England that arose in the 60s, I guess it was, from a volcano, and it made an island. But this island, Kipalina, off of Alaska, is disappearing. And so the graves, the culture, everything is going away.
What do you think about this possibility with gene manipulation to create, obviously, maybe order children in the future?
It's a nightmare. It will completely change our species.
Do you think that human nature is doomed in
yes,
that sense?
Yes. So in my story, Are We Not Men, which I wrote 3 years ago, I tell you what the scientists tell us now, that they will never manipulate human genes in this way. And in my story, the Chinese are the first to do it. And of course, once they do, yes, of course, once they do, then everybody will. You have to catch up. You have to stay even. If you're going to have an entire race of people with much higher IQs and are bigger and stronger and faster, and
it's a selection.
It will be a very much a racial selection too. What is popular? Is it blonde hair popular? Well, you can take the husband and wife, and they have genes for many characteristics, and you can see how they'll line up. Do you like musical ability? Well, we'll line up, So it will create artificial human beings. Now, a Chinese scientist said that he had edited the genes of a pair of twins in the womb. The father of these twins has AIDS. The mother does not. And the children, 99%, will not have this disease. Nonetheless, he manipulated the genes to eliminate the possibility that they could get AIDS. All right, who's going to argue with this? Except that this now creates two girls, two human beings, who are different from every other human being who ever lived. And it's not just the individuals. This is in the germline of our species forever. Now you foresee a time when there are many different kinds of gene manipulation among many different people. Then you foresee those people breeding. Wow. I mean, it's...
There will be an elite. They will be just...
Or not necessarily. I mean, we don't know. When we eliminate one gene, we don't know what the effects will be. It's really the old Frankenstein monster thing, You can't mess with Mother Nature, My God, it's alive! This is the reality that we're going towards now.
But all the same, the big question, when you say the ultimate reason or what's beyond death, it's probably impossible to be dealt.
Nonetheless, we will certainly create superhuman beings. There's no question about it. And we may be creating cyberhuman beings as well. And it would be nothing like the animals that we are now. But still, unless we go totally towards robotics and artificial intelligence, or that takes over the world, which is a possibility, the humans, no matter how they're modified, will still be humans. And humans are animals, and they will still be subject to death and the questions that we've been talking about today.
Yeah. I was wondering, there are so many dystopian novels, 1984 or Bolaño, 2066,
yeah.
And so on.
Yeah.
everyone is sort of projecting a date in the future where everything will be a mess. You tried it with 20, 25, didn't work. So which would be the date? Because I have to plan for me and my children,
and the children
to know
especially,
where
yes.
everything is gone forever. So tell me, what would you think today, being realistic? You're a realist more than a pessimist. So you say, well,
when,
you know,
when will this podcast be available?
I don't know.
Because I'm thinking probably tomorrow is the answer to your question.
Tomorrow. Okay.
Oh, boy. Yeah. It may be that every generation, as they get older and closer to death, begin to look on things with a very cold and bleak eye. Maybe that's my problem. But I don't think other generations had to deal with what we're dealing with in terms of, let's say, the right-wing movements that have taken over America and other countries as a xenophobic response to foreigners and the impoverished and so on, the fight for resources, these scientific advances we're talking about. I just don't see a whole lot of good news. I hope I'm wrong. And by the way, my plan is very simple. I'm just going to die.
Yeah. Well, I think I myself, I'm about 50, I feel myself linked to my grandfather in some central subjects of life, obviously. But our life is completely different in terms of also relationships already. And I think I feel that we had different challenges. The challenges of today sometimes I feel are more difficult than the challenges who had my ancestors.
I agree. Our society is...
If I think of my children, I think, oh my God, I don't want to live in your world. I'm sorry to have delivered you to this place.
Our societies are breaking down through the social media and the addiction to our machines, so that people don't go anywhere anymore. They don't go to the movies. They don't go to live music. They don't go to a play. We have soon the Amazon drones will be delivering everything, but in the meanwhile, the post office is delivering everything. Everybody shops online, the shops are going out of business. You know, there's no real public place to be
cohesion,
with other people,
yes, yes.
except the bar
and Boyle.
But the bar is still where people will gather. You can see people in the bar, but I have a solution to that as well. I'm creating an app that will create the virtual bar in your own house. You turn it on, and there it is. You're in a bar in your own living room. And there are a lot of good-looking women in that bar, and they never say no.
So there is always a solution for every big problem. Tom, it's wonderful what you've told me so far. I have a couple of questions more. And then
we wrap it up.
Then we're done. First question is, in your incredible work, I mean, you have a comédie, man, it's incredible, all the different stories you have gathered in your work. Is there any of those stories which is still haunting you? And not only the story, maybe just a character.
Chicxulub, my story, Chicxulub.
Mm-hmm.
This is a dramatic, non-comic story. One of my...
Mm-hmm.
The first I ever performed on stage, rather than a comedic story. This is a story that deals with random chance in the universe. The Chicxulub refers to the crater off of Mexico from the meteor, they're not sure it was a meteor or an asteroid, which extinguished the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. And the chances of such an event happening again, of course, it will at some point. And how it negates all of human life and everything we are in all our cultures, etc. But I wed it to a very specific story. A couple who have a teenage daughter, on a rainy night, are preparing to go to bed. Their daughter is out with her friends. And in fact, they're preparing to have sex. It's kind of a sexy scene. the phone rings. And the husband says, no, it's nobody, don't bother. But it's the hospital calling that the daughter has been in a terrible accident, identified by her ID, which has been driven by the force of the impact. It was in her purse, driven through that and into her flesh. That's how bad it is. And she's in the hospital in a coma, and they're trying to save her life. And the parents rush to the hospital. Meanwhile, all the alternate sections are about Chicxulub and the chances of such things occurring again, until we get to a revelatory moment toward the end of the story, which is so shocking that I have read it to audiences as big as 2,000 people in complete black, dark theater, and no one moves, no one breathes. You know, you go to the opera, you go anywhere, and there's somebody coughs and they move the chair. Nothing. Absolute. And the power of that is good. So anyway, that story is, you know, sort of a summation of everything we've talked about, you know, with regard to our condition, the human condition, if you will, and existential questions.
I have one last question. You're not going to write any autobiography, I suppose, don't you? It's in your box and it's in a very discreet way. But the important question is, you transmit or convey life through novels, but what does one lose by writing? Is there anything one loses by writing?
You lose some time out in the sunshine, maybe? No, you gain by making art. You only gain through making art. As far as autobiography is concerned, I never rule anything out. Now, I will not write an autobiography as far as I'm concerned. I'm not an autobiographical writer, yet some of my short stories begin and are rather strongly autobiographical. If the River Was Whiskey, for instance, or Greasy Lake, or Up Against the Wall, stories like this that are relatively easy to write because they are my own experience. But for nonfiction, the thing that I would point to, and of which I'm pretty happy, is the introduction to T.C. Boyle Stories 2 of my collected stories, and it gives a little raison d'etre, why am I doing this, who am I, and so on. But as far as sitting down and writing an autobiography, I don't know if I'll ever do that. I'm much more interested in writing fiction.
Yes, it's wonderful what you're saying. Probably it is even a challenge to try to say what one is. It's more difficult than, you know, to invent.
But it's at a certain stage, or any stage of life, it's always great to reflect on your past and to try to codify it and put it down, because we all want to feel that we're mm-hmm. important yeah, and significant and individual, and our experiences are different from everybody else's, as they are. But I can't foresee doing that, except in fiction.
And of course, I'm asking you now if you're into a new novel or...
I can't speak to that yet because I'm only in the research phase and I don't know if it will pan out and I'd have to write something else altogether. But once it begins and starts to go, of course, I don't mind talking about it.
Well, we are all here waiting for being, you know, again, surprised and enchanted by your work.
Oh, shucks, Piero, that's so wonderful. I think I'll go home and write the novel in my hotel room tonight.
Das war es für heute mit dem Podcast Hansa Rauschen. Das waren viele Worte für viele interessante Dinge. Bis zur nächsten Folge und danke fürs Zuhören.